Good. Yeah. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your attendance. I've got the great pleasure of introducing Alicia Inarejos. Alicia and I share a couple of commonalities. I first learned Spanish in Valencia, where she did her law degrees. She since moved on to Oxford. I dare say my allegiances are with the college opposite hers, because she was a research fellow at Brasenose, and we from Exeter College don't like the Brasenose people very much, but she's a very dear colleague here in Cambridge. She also has a very strong McGill-Montreal connection, where she was an assistant professor, and she's been, really one of the leading thinkers on EU constitutional law in this country and if not in the world. I'm very much looking forward to her discussions of legal issues surrounding the Eurozone crisis, and I can kind of see that you're also quite excited. So welcome, Alicia.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for inviting me, and thanks everyone for coming. And thanks for the very kind presentation, Marcus. So I'm going to speak about some legal issues surrounding the Eurozone crisis. This is very much work in practice. These are just some reflections on where the integration is going, what shape it's going to take, or what shape it can take, and ultimately, whether there are limits to how far economic integration can go within our current arrangements, within our current constitutional settlement. So this is going to be the structure of the talk. I'm going to say a couple of sentences about the general background, the euro crisis. I'm sure that you all know enough about it, and about the legal background, the economic and monetary union. And we'll see that it's very easy to identify the imbalance between the economic and monetary union, right? And that imbalance causes problems. And we'll see that, well, one way to address this problem is to integrate further the economic union. And of course, there's a spectrum of integration, or there's a spectrum of potential solutions that member states could theoretically go for, even if politically they don't come into question. We'll have a brief look at the solutions attempted so far, or the measures adopted so far, the six-pack, the Euro-plus pact, the new fiscal treaty, all three very different. I'll talk more about the new fiscal treaty that was agreed about a week ago and hopefully will be signed in March. And then we'll discuss what is coming next for economic integration, whether all these measures open new venues for integration or change essentially what member states can do to address the crisis, and whether there are limits to this integration. All right, so let me start with the euro crisis. And I'm sure you all know enough about this. So in one slide, at some point it became apparent that there were members of the Eurozone that had size, that had become, debt of a size that had become unmanageable. And they were at risk of a default. There was a bailout. The case that remains problematic, bailout after bailout until now, is the Greek one, where the risk of default remains. Now, states refinance their debt continuously, right? And they do this by paying debt that is due now by borrowing new, fresh money from the markets. They offer bonds, and private investors buy these bonds. And they buy these bonds because they offer an interest. Now, if there's a feeling in the market that there's a risk of default, that you may not get your money back because the country is not going to pay back, if there's a higher chance of that, you're going to need a higher reward to give that money to the state. So the interest becomes higher and higher it becomes far more expensive for the country to refinance its debt until at some point it's impossible. So the feeling in the market that there may be a default in the end may produce that default. So there's a vicious circle. The problem is compounded in the euro area because, well, normally states with fiscal problems would be able to do things with their monetary policy to address somehow, or try to address some of those problems. So they would be able to produce more currency, maybe to devalue their currency, something that is not on the table if you're part of the euro. So there was, or there still is, a risk of contagion. As the markets worry about one country, they start worrying about the risk of default in other countries. At some point, the clear risk was Italy, Spain. Emergency mechanisms were created to bail out countries that were at risk. Two provisional ones, the EFSF and the EFSM, and one permanent one, the ESM. This treaty hasn't been ratified, but the idea is that this will be a permanent bailout mechanism that will start working from 2013. How about the legal background? Well, there is an economic and monetary union, and what does that entail for the members of the euro area? Well, if you think about what states can normally do, they normally control these two things together, right? They control their monetary policy, they control the production of currency, the interest. Together with their macroeconomic policy, they decide how much to tax, how much money to obtain, and how to spend that money. So these two things normally go together. When designing the economic and monetary union, we decided to disaggregate, to separate these twins. And we gave the monetary policy, exclusive control of the monetary policy to the union, and we left national economic policy with the member states within certain limits, right? Certain loose limits. So there are structural rules that tell states you cannot have a size that is bigger than this, deficit bigger than this, right? So rules about, external rules about the budget. So we had a stability and growth pact containing those rules. But actually it wasn't very effective because the sanctions in the end were political, or it was a political decision whether to impose the sanctions or not, and so in the end they were never imposed. And when it comes, so those are structural rules. When it comes to substantive policy economic areas, there's mere coordination of the national policies, right? So they're just some general guidelines issued by the council. That's all, right? So we have total centralization of the monetary policy, loose coordination of economic policies that remain national in nature. So there's an imbalance between these two. Why is that a problem? Well, many say it's at the heart of the crisis because a very strong currency allowed some members of the euro area to borrow too much, as in more than they wouldn't been able to borrow, judging just by their fiscal policies or by the state of their own economies. Again, they cannot use monetary policy to alleviate fiscal problems if they run into trouble. One potential national default affects the currency of all euro states. Remember the risk of contagion. But also, independent fiscal policies mean that ultimately there's no control over whether this happens again. And even if you bail out a couple of countries, there's no guarantee that the same is not going to happen next year. And it's also, politically, it's very difficult to sell this to your electorate at home if you're one of the countries that is footing the bill, right? Because you're giving the money, but you have absolutely no guarantee that that is going to be spent in the way that you think it should be spent, or there's no incentive for fiscal responsibility. Right? There's no incentive for the countries that receive the money to actually become more responsible. And I'm not saying that's the problem, but you know, that's the view of the electorate in certain countries, and it's very difficult to change it. So, what to do? Right, well, we've seen that bailouts are a possibility, and for a while we thought that was going to be the solution, at least to the acute part of the problem. Right, we have a very specific crisis now, we bail out Ireland, we bail out Greece, and the markets come down, it all goes back to normal. And we thought that later on, in the longer term, we can worry about that imbalance between monetary and economic union, and we can think of other ways to try and coordinate further or integrate further. As it turned out, bailouts were not even going to be solutions, temporary solutions or short-term solutions, because they even failed to calm down the markets. So we are left with this need to address this imbalance that we were talking about, the asymmetry between a very strong central monetary policy and decentralized national economic policies. So suppose the solution is to integrate national economic policies further. Either you coordinate it more effectively or you integrate further. But how and how far do you go? Right, so imagine a potential spectrum of integration, right? All the things that we could do to bring the economic policy to the level of the monetary union. Now, at one end of the spectrum, we have very loose political coordination of economic national policies, no enforceable legal obligations, no involvement of the supranational actors, right? So political commitments. Of course, the problem with this, this is to a certain degree what we already have. It's not difficult to have this. But the problem is, of course, that it doesn't seem to be effective. The commitments don't seem credible. It's very difficult to calm down markets if they start worrying about things. Now, the other far end, the opposite end of the spectrum, unthinkable as it may be, we have a full economic union, right? A union with its own independent, full economic policy that it carries out through measures of EU law, so legally binding measures. And of course, all the supranational actors are involved. We have the Commission, the Court, maybe even the Parliament. And so member states have potentially lost control of these decisions of economic policy. And of course, there are all sorts of degrees in between. And how far member states are willing to integrate will, of course, depend on what specific decisions of economic policy we are talking about. And so there will be very delicate matters, and they will want to maintain control. Maybe it changes with different matters. Let's have a look at the solutions that have been adopted so far. Right, these are the Six Pack, the Euro Plus Pact, and the new treaty. And I said in the beginning that they're very different. Just bearing in mind what I said about the different degrees of integration, we can locate them in a map of integration in this way. And there's far too much information on this table. But for now, I just want you to see how all these measures can be classified in this map of integration. And it will all make more sense at the end of the presentation, I hope. But for now, just see how we can classify things according to how much control member states are willing to give up, right? So on the left, the green column, they can do things on an intergovernmental basis, political agreements, soft law, sharing best practices, etc. Then slowly they can start cooperating on a supranational basis, measures that are enforceable, using the EU institutions, etc. And of course, all sorts of degrees in between. In yellow, I've classified different kinds of economic decisions that you would expect to see as part of an economic policy. And the first one is structural rules, right? Those rules that we were talking about that determine how big the debt of a state can be its deficit. Right? Those rules, member states have been willing to commit to those rules on a supranational basis. They have adopted EU law to enforce those rules, and they've tried to make this stronger with the six-pack, which we will discuss in a second. The rest, though, they're all policy decisions. Right? As soon as all these decisions concern substantive policy economic areas rather than just the size of debt or the balance of the budget, it gets more and more difficult to have any sort of enforceable rule. We have very abstract policy guidelines. They're, of course, intergovernmental by their very nature, very loose political agreements, the Euro-plus pact. As soon as we go towards the right of the table, decisions on allocation of resources, we're going to see that that's where it's going to be very difficult to have the EU play a meaningful role. It's not going to be able to adopt its own decisions on allocation of resources to the extent that that would amount to having its own economic policy, and it doesn't have the necessary competence in the treaties at the moment. We'll see that it can adopt certain rules that will have impact on allocation of resources, like a common corporate tax base, but that will be because it has another more specific competence in the single market, and that would be a single market rule. Right? In any case, we'll go back to the table later on. Now that I've sort of showed you where the measures would fit in a map of integration, we're going to talk very briefly about each of them. Now, the six-pack is a package of six measures of EU law aimed at strengthening those structural rules I was talking about, right? The size of debt, the deficit. These measures, they strengthen the sanction regime for breaches of the Stability and Growth Pact so as to make it more effective, more credible. It's supposed to be easier to impose sanctions on states that breach the Stability and Growth Pact. It also introduces a procedure to monitor and correct macroeconomic imbalances identified by the Commission. So if we go back to the table for a second, these are those structural rules that have been adopted on a supranational basis, right? When it comes to these kind of rules, we can have EU law. The second one is the Euro-plus pact. It's a political agreement, no enforceable obligations. It was adopted in March 2011, by the way, and I forgot to say that the six-pack was adopted in November 2011. So these are all very, they're close to each other, obvious attempts to address the crisis quite quickly. In this political agreement, states undertake to cooperate to improve competitiveness, public finance, employment, and financial stability. But there are no concrete commitments, right? And nothing is enforceable. They make it clear at several points that the policy choices, the specific policy choices, remain with each state. So these would be policy decisions, right? But we are at this level of cooperation, very abstract policy guidelines, political agreements, nothing more. How about the new fiscal treaty? Does it take us any further, or does it change anything? Well, the new fiscal treaty was agreed at the end of January 2012. It's supposed to be signed in March. It's an intergovernmental treaty outside the structure of the EU. The idea was for it to be part of the structure of the EU, but the UK decided not to sign it. And now, in the end, the Czech Republic is not going to be a part of it either, apparently. Now, it has two most important fronts. The first one, budgetary discipline. Again, those structural rules we were talking about, rules on the size of debt, deficit, And the treaty repeats them, but also says that they have to be implemented into national law. So it creates a new obligation for the contracting parties. When we get to policy, to coordination of national economic policies, the treaty merely points towards the possibility of soft law and to the use of EU law, mostly through enhanced cooperation. Now, first thought about the fiscal treaty is the role of the EU institutions. So in the beginning, people were discussing to what extent it would be legal to have a treaty like this outside the EU give a role to the EU institutions. And it was going to be problematic. So you can see with the agreed text, the final text, that the drafters had been very careful in this regard. So whenever there's a role, whenever the role of the Commission is mentioned or described, for example, it's either a role that the Commission already had because of the six-pack, for example, or the treaty is very careful not to create a duty for the Commission to act. So it says things like the Commission is invited to submit a report if it wants to, I suppose, or if it feels like it. The Court of Justice has a role as well, but it's also a limited role. The Court of Justice reviews or can review whether member states have implemented these rules as to the size of their debt, limits to the size of their deficit, into their national law properly. But this is okay because this sort of thing is already foreseen in the EU treaties. Article 273 says that some member states may agree to something like this, an international agreement, and they may agree to give jurisdiction to the Court of Justice. Right? So, and they make clear in the new fiscal treaty that that's what they're doing, that they're using Article 273. So they try to keep it non-polemic, the use of the EU institutions. Apart from that, does the treaty actually add anything? Does it solve the imbalance within the economic and monetary union? Does it bring us any further? Well, let's look again at the two fronts that I mentioned. Right, as regards budgetary discipline, the one thing that it adds is that member states or the contracting parties have to implement this rule into their national law. Right? In the beginning, the deal was that they were going to have to do this into their constitution. But subsequent drafts of the treaty have mollified this, and now it says that it's preferable if they do it into their constitution, but you know, other law is fine. The rest, we already, pretty much the same ground we covered with the six-pack as regards budgetary discipline. How about the coordination of national economic policies, which is the most problematic? Well, you know, we see that the treaty points us to the possibility of soft law. Earlier drafts mentioned the Europlus Pact, for example, but that's always a possibility. That's a possibility that was always there. You know, member states were always able to draft this sort of political agreement. And what about EU law? It points us towards enhanced cooperation. Again, enhanced cooperation, a mechanism that allows certain member states to make use of an EU competence, even if the other member states don't want to make use of it. That's a mechanism that was already in the treaties. So the new fiscal treaty doesn't really create anything in this regard. It's true that it may have great political significance. Or they intended this treaty at least to have political significance in the sense that it would show the political leaders taking control of the situation, taking control of the crisis, in the end calming the markets and the investors, which it is doubtful whether this treaty will have that effect. It probably also has the political effect that Merkel is able to go to her electorate and say, do not worry too much about this bailout, because even though we give this money, now there are more, now there's more control as to how this money is going to be spent. There's more budgetary discipline imposed on all these countries. Not really. I mean, it replicates the six-pack. And it does say that that all countries have to put it into their national law, but it's not such a big deal. Further, it may perhaps create political momentum. You know, it may lead to different things in the future because it creates an inertia. But the treaty itself does not add that much. So where does that leave us? What next for economic integration? Well, we have the same dichotomy that we had before, right? Either we do things through soft law, broad political agreements, guidelines, benchmarking, that sort of thing. In which case, we have to worry about effectiveness, perhaps. How effective is that going to be? How credible are those commitments going to be? Is it actually going to make national economic policies coordinate further? Is it going to make the markets believe that there is an overarching coordination of national economic policies? And depending on your view of soft law, you probably end up worrying about legitimacy and maybe transparency, depending on how far the idea of soft law is taken. So that's the one way. Either we do that, or, you know, according to the fiscal treaty, we use EU law, right? And this is where everybody thought, well, maybe this is the next era of EU integration, an economic policy for the union. Except that if you look at the treaties, you see that the EU has a very weak competence when it comes to economic policy. Right? It has merely a coordinating competence. That means it's supposed to offer some sort of forum within which the member states coordinate their own policies, but those policies remain national. Right? The EU doesn't have the power to have its own independent policy, which means that it doesn't have the power to legislate. It doesn't have the power to adopt decisions and then enforce them. Maybe even impose them on member states who don't agree with them because they've been outvoted. So an independent policy is out of the question. Why does the fiscal treaty point us towards enhanced cooperation? Well, that's not going to change much, in terms of competence at least, right? Because enhanced cooperation only allows member states to use a competence that is already there in the treaty if they want to, but despite the disagreement of other member states, or despite the fact that other member states don't want to use that competence, rather. But the competence has to be there already, right? You can't create it through enhanced cooperation. Which means that we are going to be able to do little with EU law. I mean, it may be significant, but it won't be an economic policy. It will be very discrete measures that the EU will be able to adopt because of a different competence, because of a more specific competence like the single market. In which case, we're not really creating anything in terms of a new policy. We are simply expanding or making more use of a competence that we already had, namely the single market. So when people talk now about a common corporate tax base, for example, or a financial transactions tax, that doesn't mean that we're going to have this new economic policy area and these measures are going to keep coming because of that. These are just going to be single market measures. So those are the limits of competence. that we currently have in the treaty and that we have to observe because of the principle of conferral. So how about extending competence? Right? Member states can always get together and extend the competence of the treaty through an amendment. If the crisis gets worse, could they create a common economic policy, just do away completely with this asymmetry between the monetary union and the economic union? And this runs into difficulties. Of course, the first one is political reality, but I don't think we even have to address that. It is very unlikely that the member states would agree to this. If the UK, for example, is not willing to sign this treaty that doesn't really add much, then there's no way that we're going to get everyone to agree to a common economic policy, right? Of course, that's out of the question. But, you know, these things change. I mean, if the crisis has shown us something, is that all of a sudden it changes the political agenda, or it's able to change the political agenda quite rapidly. In any case, let's think of the conceptual problems that the creation of a common economic policy would run into. I mean, first we have the principle of conferral. And I don't mean that in the sense that you need to exercise a competence that is given to you in the treaty, because, you know, we would comply with that if this sort of competence were created in the treaty. But I think that depending on how this competence is designed, of course, one potential danger is we risk voiding the principle of conferral of any meaning in reality, right? The principle of conferral is supposed to protect national competence, national sovereignty, areas of competence that remain with the member states. And the idea is, if the Union were to have a full common economic policy, if we were able to decide, right, so let's say we take it to the extreme, and the Union is able to decide on the allocation of resources in all sorts of areas, right? Then in the end, it doesn't matter anymore that it is the member states that have the competence to regulate education or health, because the EU holds the purse strings, right? So the principle of conferral formally would still exist and we would still comply with it, but how useful would it be as a mechanism or as a constitutional principle of the EU? And of course it's possible to have it like that. It's just that a union that has this sort of competence is a very different creature from the union that we have today. And the principle of conferral may not be a meaningful basis for it anymore. Now, the third problem is a mixture of a theoretical and a practical problem, I suppose. And it has to do with national constitutional courts. And the fact that some of these national constitutional courts have, in the past, expressed their concern, or they have hinted at the possibility that there's a limit to how many competences or how much power we can transfer to the Union within the current arrangement. And I'm going to use the example of the German Constitutional Court because it has done this expressly in the Lisbon decision and discussed this at length. So in this decision, the court drew a very clear link between certain substantive areas, democratic legitimacy, and the state. And said, if you have to decide in these areas, or if you want to decide in these areas, you have to have certain democratic legitimacy that you only get in a state, right? So unless you want to make the EU a state, which is up to you, it's just that you would have to change the treaties and destroy the national constitutions or change them substantially. But unless you want to create an EU federal state, certain areas will always have to remain within the purview of national democracy. And he went so far as to enumerate certain areas two of them, fundamental fiscal decisions on public revenue and expenditure, decisions on the shaping of the social state. Now, again, of course, this is just one potential pitfall. It doesn't mean that if we design a common economic policy that it would necessarily tread into this territory, but it may do. It's very likely that the EU would end up taking some of these decisions. So some final reflections. Integration now with the current treaties that we have. Right? We've seen that we can draw a clear line between structural rules, right, rules as to debt, deficit, the balance of the budget, so external rules, and decisions in substantive economic policy. You know, decisions that more or less directly have to do with the allocation of resources. The latter, right, decisions that have to do with the allocation of resources, policy decisions, at the moment are going to be confined to soft law with very limited competence for the EU to adopt legislation. So, again, structural rules, EU law, not a problem. Policy rules, if we want to create specific decisions on allocation of resources, it's going to be very difficult from the point of view of the EU. Except if we're talking about decisions, concrete decisions that the EU, or rules that the EU can adopt, because it does so on the basis of the single market. Such as a common corporate tax base, for example. In this area, we would have other decisions on allocation of resources that we cannot adopt using the single market, that wouldn't pass the tobacco advertising test. Things like we need to reform our system of direct taxation, or we need to reform pensions. How about a future EU policy? Those are the limits of the present, right? How about amending the treaties to create something new? And there I've talked about perhaps voiding the principle of conferral of meaning. It's all depending on how we would end up designing such a policy, but these are the potential pitfalls to avoid. And the most important question, I think, the question of democratic legitimacy. In the end, the question is, how much do we think that we can decouple the fundamentals of an economic policy from national politics? Right, of course, this decoupling has already occurred in certain areas. It has happened in the single market, for example, and we are fine with it. I mean, we may think that it would be nice to improve democratic legitimacy, but we think that it's sufficient generally. We accept that, right? Because we either think that the EU is able to generate enough of its own democratic legitimacy at the EU level, because we think it's indirectly legitimized through the national executives. Either way, we accept the single market. We accept this decoupling. Are we willing to do the same for the fundamentals of a full economic policy? And I think intuitively, most people would say no. And I wonder whether that's because it's such a fundamental question, because in the end it goes to how do we allocate finite resources within a society, so it goes to our idea of a fair society, maybe, or because it's so overarching, because you allocate resources, and that means you end up predetermining what can be done in any area of government activity. So the general question for the future, of course, is, are there limits to integration within the current structure? Of course, there must be such limits. But is economic policy one of those limits? And specifically, why? Is it because of the fundamental question? Because of the overarching feature? So what's going to happen next for the EU is that we're going to see member states trying to navigate between, or trying to square the circle between, the ineffectiveness of acting in an intergovernmental basis with soft law, with political agreements, without involving the EU institutions, and potentially dissolving the state. Right? It's a bit dramatic, but that may be how certain national constitutional courts will see it. Emptying national politics of meaning. And we are going to have to find, most likely, new forms of economic convergence that are more effective. Or maybe we are going to have to design a shared economic policy for the EU that avoids these pitfalls. Maybe we can find the tools to create a policy that is effective and is able to impose commitments on the member states without running into the problems we have talked about. So that's work for the future. Thank you.